So welcome to Street Hypnosis. This is session 3 of the masterclass entitled How to Really Use NLP for Amazing Results. So this is basically a crash course in NLP, particularly for hypnotists, but for anyone really, giving you all the insights and background to understand what NLP is, how it works, and to make it work. Actually, this whole session, everything we've been doing in the first two sessions, today's session and the next session as well, is going to teach you pretty much every single thing that you need to learn for a NLP practitioner. So if you ever go to a live program, you will learn everything you've learned here, and you'll be missing very, very little. Everyone has their own little extra bits and pieces from time to time, of course. Now, the core of NLP comes down to basically five things. You have the concepts, which we dealt with in session 1. Then we have the language, which we dealt with in session 2. The language is very, very important. Then we have reframing, anchoring, and submodalities. With these five things, the concepts, the language, reframing, anchoring, and submodalities, with these five building blocks, we get to create the infamous NLP techniques, the ones that, like the fast phobia cure, allow you to break a phobia in 15, 20 minutes, that, like the swish or visual squash, allow you to make all kinds of personal changes or help other people make changes. But really, it's important that you understand the building blocks that those were all made up of so that you can understand the mechanisms that you're using. So I could teach you the techniques, and I will teach you those techniques, absolutely. But if all you can do is parrot them blindly, then they'll work sometimes for you, and other times they will fail miserably. Whereas if you build your knowledge up consistently and carefully and step by step, as we've been doing so far, then you'll understand how everything's made up, and you'll understand what is happening if something isn't going according to plan, so that you'll be able to change it. Now, we mentioned that today we're going to be looking at reframing, anchoring, and submodalities as concepts and as a basic technique. So let's start off with the idea of reframing. What do we mean by reframing? Well, before we can even look at reframing, we need to ask the question, what is a frame? And to answer that, I'm going to answer that with another question. How do we know what something means? How do we know when we're talking about something, what it's supposed to mean, and how we're supposed to respond to it? Now, let me give an example. Sean, are you online?
Yep.
So, Sean, if I told you, if I set a scenario for you, let's imagine that you're driving your car and you come to a red light, you come to a stop, right?
Yep.
So, whilst you're waiting for the lights to change, you hear a siren, you turn around, you see an ambulance with its blue lights flashing, and it races through the red light. How do you feel about that ambulance?
Absolutely fine.
Sure. Now let's contrast this to a similar situation. After the ambulance races through the red lights, you see a guy in a red Ferrari with his shirt half open, and he drives through the same red light right after the car. What do you think about this guy?
Is he following the ambulance, or he's just driven through?
You're waiting, and he's just driving right through the red lights. What do you think about that guy?
I think that was a bit cheeky, to be honest.
You think a bit cheeky, right? So yeah. Think about it. We have identical events. We have a vehicle, four wheels, lights, the works, and we have red lights, and you're stopped by the red light, and we have both these vehicles moving through the red light, and yet you have a very different reaction because of what you think the event means, right?
Yeah.
So let's see if we can change the meaning around a little bit by adding some information. Let's say that as the ambulance drives through, one of the doors pops open, and you see a bunch of college kids having a party in the back, and maybe one of them drops his trousers in the moon, right? Yeah. How do you feel about that ambulance now?
I think they're pretty reckless, to be honest.
Pretty reckless, right? Yeah. Now, let's say that I tell you that the guy in the Ferrari, same scenario. So the ambulance is driven through, and the guy in the Ferrari is actually the husband of a woman who's in the back of the ambulance. She's pregnant, she's fallen down some stairs, and there's no room for him in the ambulance, so he's racing to be there at the hospital to meet her when the doors open up. How do you feel about him now?
Completely different, because that's obviously fair enough.
Absolutely right. But think about it. We haven't changed the events. The context hasn't changed. The meaning has changed. So reframing is the art of changing the meaning of an event. How do we do this? Well, we do this in exactly the same way we just did this in our little thought experiment. We do this by adding information to the system. When we add information to something, it changes the context or it changes the meaning. In other words, we look at the situation from a different light because we see more things, we see different things, or we see things in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So what we just discovered here is the two special types of reframing that you'll focus on, particularly as the NLP practitioner. These are known as content reframes and context reframes. So what are the differences? Well, let's take the content reframe. A content reframe is basically what we're most familiar with in terms of, say, positive thinking, or, you know, when people say, just look at it another way. You know the old expression, every cloud has a silver lining? Well, that's kind of a metaphorical description of what a content reframe is. In a content reframe, the attitude that you take into your mind is basically, well, just look at things this way. Look at the bright side of things. Look at it as meaning this. And this is something that we are reasonably familiar with as individuals, because we tend to do this to a greater or lesser extent in our day-to-day lives. We'll be saying that to our friends, we'll be saying to our family members. We hear politicians doing that to us in a negative sense many times, where we don't necessarily trust what they're saying. But even so, the changing of a meaning happens because they change the frame by wanting us to understand the content in a different way. A context reframe, on the other hand, is something that many people are less familiar with, although it still does happen reasonably often. A context reframe is when you maintain the same behavior, the same ideas, the same things going on, but you change the situation around. So rather than being something inappropriate, it goes into a new situation where it becomes very useful. So as an example, fighting or violence is not normally considered a useful thing. You know, this person's a violent person. But you change the context. You put it into a situation, for example, where they're fighting for their life, or they're fighting for someone else's life, or fighting for their country. Suddenly, the violence which was before considered a bad thing now becomes a good thing, a positive force. So both in content and context reframing, we are taking the attitude that everything in life serves a purpose. It may not serve a decent purpose in the context given or in the way that people perceive it, but if you change your perception of it or you change the times that you do it, it will become valuable. I would like to give you an example of context reframing in action. Now, this example comes from an old Chinese proverb, or rather a old Chinese sort of wisdom tale. And the story goes as follows. A young man from a poor family is running through the woods, and as he does so, he finds a horse and takes it home. And all the villagers are ecstatic and say how lucky he is, and, you know, he's found a horse which is so valuable and how fortunate he is. But the father, being a wise man, just says, maybe, we'll see. Now, 2 days later, as the young man is trying to break the horse and, you know, learn to ride it, he falls off and breaks a leg. And the villagers come round and they're all sad and lonely and saying, well, how sad it is, how terrible, he's broken his leg, and, you know, how terrible and a misfortune. Again, the father, being a wise man, turns around and says, maybe, we'll just have to see. Some weeks later, the emperor's army is coming through on the way to war. There's a big battle looming, and they need young men to fight. So they conscript everyone of fighting age, except, of course, the young man, because with a broken leg, he's totally useless to them. So all the villagers come round, and who are left, of course, and say, what great fortune. He's broken his leg, and he's safe from the war. And again, the father, being a wise man, says, maybe, we'll see. Now, this story is an elegant example of context reframing in action. and it changes the context by changing the time sequence. So finding a horse, considered, in other words, having more wealth, everyone thinks it's a great thing. But by changing the context, looking at a bigger picture, to a time when he breaks his leg, it suddenly becomes a negative thing. And of course, by changing the bigger picture again and seeing the army arriving and conscripting young men, it becomes again a positive thing for having broken his leg. So basically, things can mean anything given the right context and the way you look at it. So when we're reframing, we want to practice certain kind of mindsets. The two basic mindsets that I'd like you guys to get used to is, number one, the Pollyanna frame. The Pollyanna frame is basically look for the good in a situation. How do we do that? Well, very simply. You can play a game, for example, what I would call happy tennis, where you take a situation, it doesn't matter what situation, like I dropped some money in the street today, or I found some money in the street today, or I'm handing my homework in late. Take any circumstance like that, and then the challenge is between yourself and a friend to find the silver lining in that event. Now, and keep going backwards and forwards. So the idea is that as soon as you come up with a reframe, a reason why that might be a good thing, then the other person comes up with one, and then you come up with one, and you keep going until one of you stumbles or stutters or draws a blank, at which point, of course, you chalk up a point, and then you start the next round. It's a simple little game. It's quite fun to do, and it teaches you something of immense importance. And that is to say that to be able to do reframing, you enter a special state of mind, and you can only do that by really doing it. You emphasize the positive, and then your mind starts looking for ways of looking at things which could be useful. Now, this, by the way, is a tremendous exercise to get used to just on your own anyway. In other words, the quality of life that you will draw out of this by doing this on a consistent basis, like playing it 10 minutes a day with a friend, will be immense, because it will rewire your entire thinking to be more positive, to genuinely look for the good in life and to enjoy it. So it's a great fun activity, something great to get used to. And once you do this, you really get used to the idea of content reframing, becoming good at this. Now, in terms of context reframing, remember, in context reframing, we take a behavior and we will change the context, we'll change the situation around so that it suddenly becomes a positive. You can do a similar sort of thing. But then the question to ask yourself is not, where is the silver lining in this cloud? But rather, where do we need the clouds? A cloud raining on your parade may not be the right place for a cloud to be, but a cloud raining over a dry field is something that everyone desires. So notice that when a cloud is raining on a parade, you can either look for the silver lining in the crowd, but you're still in the parade, or you go to another context, you go to the dry fields, and you discover that suddenly the rain is a good thing, something very, very necessary. So with these ideas, I want you to kind of keep them in the back of your mind, because whenever you do any kind of NLP intervention, really at some level, all interventions end up being a reframe. Whether you do it overtly by saying, just look at life this way, or you're doing it more indirectly because they spontaneously start looking at life differently, some kind of reframe must take place, because that's how people shift their attention, they shift how they feel about things. Now, this is as true when you become a coach or a therapist as if you're using NLP techniques in sales or management or for influence in any other kind of situation. Now, the final thought I'd like to leave you with in terms of reframing is this idea. And that's basically the look at the NLP presuppositions that we covered in session one with new eyes. The NLP presuppositions are essentially a whole bunch of reframes that you adopt as an NLP practitioner. And if you adopt those reframes, if you pretend that they are actually true, they increase the quality of your life, they increase your ability to communicate more elegantly and efficiently, and they'll be much more empowering. In other words, you will have much more control and influence over your environment and the people in your environment than you would otherwise have. I mean, let's take, for example, the NLP presupposition, there's no such thing as failure, there's only feedback. Now, what would you say that is? Is that a context reframe or a content reframe?
Is it content?
Absolutely right. It's an example of a content reframe. When people, quote unquote, fail at a task, there is no real meaning to that. It's just an event. Now, how you choose to perceive that as failure or as feedback or something else entirely is really entirely a question of your attitude and your internal representation of something. Now, the beauty of this is, of course, if you choose one over the other, it tends to be more empowering. If you see all the events that we're going to choose to call failure for the moment as failures, what it tends to do is it tends to shut you down. It makes you less likely to engage again. It makes you more likely to be afraid of the failure. And hence, after a series of trials, after a few failures, you'll probably give up the field and you won't learn anymore. If, on the other hand, we convert these failures into feedback, now there's no negative connotations, there's no negative emotions, it's just information. Information goes back into the system, and each time you allow the information to change you, in other words, you think about it and you try a new approach, over a period of time, it allows you to guarantee success because all that you have to do is keep learning from the information that comes back, and ultimately, you'll work out the right combination of things to do in order to get the result that you want. So, the NLP presupposition, there's no such thing as failure, only feedback, is a reframe that is designed to empower you to be more experimental and to allow yourself to walk through the world with a greater sense of curiosity. And that's one of the key attitudes behind NLP. So now we already understand that reframes, whether they're content or context reframes, are there to empower people, to take people away from negative ways of looking the same, looking at themselves or the world, so that they feel bad, and turning them to more positive ways of looking at themselves or the world, so that they are more successful in engaging with it, or that their quality of life increases. So do you guys understand how reframes work and what they are? Okay. So let's turn to anchoring. Anchoring is something which a lot of people are fascinated by, and in particular in NLP has become very famous for many of its anchoring techniques. Before we look at anchoring as the actual method, let's look back at where anchoring comes from. Back at the turn of the 20th century, around about 1902, we had a couple of scientists and a doctor who made reasonably simultaneous discoveries. The first was a doctor called William Twitmyer, who basically wrote a paper on the knee-jerk reflex. This is the idea where if you cross your legs and a doctor comes and hits on the soft part of your kneecap with a little hammer, your knee just sort of jerks. It's called the knee-jerk reflex. Now, what Dr. Twitmyer found was that after hundreds of trials, in other words, he would test this over and over and over again on different conditions to figure out how this knee-jerk reflex actually works. He started discovering a very curious thing. He would pick up the hammer and get ready to strike the knee, and yet the knee would jerk before he even had a chance to do anything. In other words, just the act of lifting the hammer somehow made the person anticipate the strike, and the knee would jerk by itself. And he thought it was very curious. Unfortunately, he thought it was curious, but not curious enough to investigate. That actually came down to a young scientist called Pavlov, who's very famous for what's known as Pavlov's dogs. Now, Pavlov went to a university to do initially trials or studies on the digestive systems of dogs. What he discovered by accident, the way they basically was investigating the digestive system of the dogs, was he would operate on the dogs and basically would implant a glass plate by their stomachs so that post-operation they could watch the gastric juices doing their thing in the dogs when they fed them. Now, one of the things that they discovered was that when they were feeding dogs, that curiously, sometimes the digestive tract, salivation of the glands in the mouth and the digestive tract itself, would start operating without any simulation. In other words, sometimes when he gave them food, right, not, usually when he provided food, the dogs would salivate and the stomach would start secreting juices and it would do the normal thing of digesting the food. But sometimes this would happen when no food was present. And this really drove him up the wall. He wanted to find out what's going on here. So he basically started a whole series of experiments, the upshot of which is very famous, where he basically wired dogs up through a tube system to provide a food pellet. And he would ring a bell that would warn the dogs that some food was coming, then he would feed them, and he'd keep doing this. Now, after a period of a certain amount of trials, we're talking about hundreds of trials, the dogs would associate the sound of the bell to food coming. And without even thinking, just by ringing the bells, the mouth would start salivating and the stomach would prepare itself for digesting food, even though no food was present or would ever come. This was later to be known as the conditioned response. In other words, we're taking an event which is normally outside of conscious control, you can't choose to salivate consciously, and we are associating a stimulus to it, the ringing of the bell, for example, so that whenever the bell rings, something which would normally happen under completely different conditions happens automatically as well. So you now have, if you like, an anchor, a way of holding on to a response that you can't get by normal means, but you can now fire off at any time you should want or choose to. Now, NLP dived onto this. While technically speaking, conditioned responses are about behavior, NLP adapted this idea of conditioned responses and focused on doing this for basically emotions, emotional states of being. Now we'll look at why we're focusing on emotional states in a moment. But the key distinction between the NLP anchoring system and a traditional conditioned response is basically that NLP focuses on the emotional part of a situation, and that NLP has a few tricks up its sleeves in order to facilitate the planting of the association, or in other words, the setting of the anchor. And the reason it has a few tricks up its sleeves is quite simple. There is a big problem with the traditional conditioned stimulus response chain. And actually, I've mentioned in passing, believe it or not, in my brief description so far. Anyone care to hazard a guess what the problem, or should I say, the impractical aspect of conditioned responses are?
Takes hundreds and hundreds of trials.
You're
Is that too long?
exactly right. Now, depending, of course, how you condition it, you will need to have fewer or greater trials. But for the most part, we're talking about numbers being in the hundreds, not, just two or three times to do it. And unless you're a scientist in the lab coat and have a lot of patience and a lot of time, for the most part, you don't have the time or the luxury to repeat the sequence literally hundreds of times. If you try and do that with another person, probably they'll get frustrated with you. If you try doing it with a person covertly, in other words, you try and anchor someone without them really realizing that you're anchoring them, then there's no way you can do this unless you're willing to invest years into this and allow the appropriate opportunity to arise. So, looking at conditioned responses in the purely traditional sense, there are two things that go into creating the association. Those two things are basically repetition and intensity. Now, if you repeat something very often, you'll create an association and you'll have your conditioned response, your anchor, if you like. If you repeat something fewer times but really increase the intensity, in other words, the emotional aspect of the experience, you end up having fewer repetitions before the lesson, so to speak, is learned, before the association sets. At the one extreme, this is known as one trial learning. One trial learning, we have plenty of examples in the world. A classic example, of course, is a phobia. Something happens to you, for example, a dog jumps up and attacks you, which is so shocking. In other words, it has such a strong emotional intensity attached that your unconscious mind just picks up the message, sticks with it, and the association is paired there and then. In other words, you need no more repetitions. That one event, has created the association, you now have an anchor. Every time you see a dog, any dog, bam, it gets refired and you have the same response again. In other words, a great deal of fear. So already we begin to have a sense of a hint at how to create anchors more elegantly. So if we don't want to have lots of repetitions, we can intensify the experience, increase the intensity. And in so doing, we increase the likelihood that the unconscious mind will pair the association. Now, when I speak of one-trial learning, by the way, let me just say this. There is a third, although very unreliable example of one-trial learning, which doesn't require either an intensity of experience or a repetition of the experience. And this is kind of a strange and mysterious phenomenon that is not fully understood yet, whereby the unconscious mind literally just will make a association with something at random, and it'll have an effect, even though there is no intensity and there is no repetition. It can still create a conditioned response. In other words, it can still create an unconscious association. The problem with that particular aspect is it's so random, unless you do what we're about to talk about, that we have no control over it. We've got control over intensity to a certain extent. We definitely have control over repetition, but we don't have control over random events. In other words, the unconscious mind randomly deciding what it chooses to associate to what because it feels like it according to some internal parameters. So now that we have the problem, which is the idea of we don't have enough time, we don't have enough time to repeat the sequence to condition it according to the classical model. What is the secret of NLP? How does NLP manage to do these crazy anchors in moments and have them work for a lifetime, if necessary? Well, the secret to this is hypnosis. Remember, we started off this series, this whole class, by defining hypnosis as a kind of a covert form of pretty much direct, for the most part, direct hypnosis. Now, if you treat anchoring as a hypnotic process, it becomes something known as a post-hypnotic suggestion. A simple definition of a post-hypnotic suggestion is you have someone in trance, in hypnosis, you give them a suggestion like, when I rub my eyebrow, you'll feel an itch on your shoulder and you want to scratch it. Or when I rub my eyebrow, you'll feel really happy. When I rub my eyebrow, you'll jump up and shout, I feel like rocking tonight. These are all classic examples of post-hypnotic suggestions, particularly used in stage hypnosis. But if you think about it, if all it takes is one example of that, and now every time you rub your eyebrow, which is the stimulus, the trigger, that they now end up jumping up and doing the behavior or having a certain emotional response, well, guess what you've just done there? You've just created a conditioned response in one trial without necessarily having to use a lot of intensity of emotion. So what we're talking about really when we talk about anchoring is we're talking about a specialized form of post-hypnotic suggestion which we're going to use in order to be able to trigger at will an emotional state in someone, although you could also anchor behaviors and similar responses and even thoughts sometimes if you're quick enough. The most useful functional way to use anchors is in terms of states. Now, if we're going to be using hypnosis in order to make anchoring a quick, easy, and simple thing to do, then we need to bear in mind that all the hypnotic things that we've been talking about in terms of hypnosis still apply. And what is that? Well, hypnosis, remember, is a special state of mind where the unconscious mind acts without inhibition from the critical factor, which is grossly labeled the conscious mind. So given that, what would be the kind of steps you need to go through in order to anchor someone? Well, the rough steps are as follows. First of all, you need to have something to anchor. Technically or typically, you'll want to have an emotional experience, in other words, a state, a way of feeling, confidence, happiness, relaxation, sometimes even negative, like things like disgust or frustration or fear. Those can also, given the right context, be useful. But if you have nothing to anchor, well, then you have nothing to anchor. So there's nothing to set the trigger to. You could suggest directly a response. In other words, every time you see me do the following, you'll get the following response. That's a very direct way of doing it, and sometimes it's appropriate, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes you want to mix the idea of a post-hypnotic suggestion with the more classical conditioning process and use what's called a non-verbal suggestion. Now, the reason this is very useful is because that allows you to do a lot of covert changes. It allows you to anchor a state or a condition without the other person necessarily knowing that that is what you're doing. And that is very, very useful to us, especially when you consider the hypnotic nature of NLP. Anyone care to hazard a guess as to why?
Could it bypass conscious resistance?
Exactly. 100% right on the money. If the other person doesn't know that you're doing it, how can they interfere with their conscious mind? How can they criticize, analyze, or whatever it is that's going on? They can't interfere with the process. It's a pure unconscious process and falls smack bang in the middle of our hypnotic definition. So when you start setting anchors outside of conscious awareness, it allows you to basically create the perfect hypnotic context in order for you to succeed. And remember, for a hypnotic context to exist, you want three things. That's encapsulated in the ABS formula. You want to absorb their attention. You want to bypass their critical factor or their regular way of thinking. And you want to stimulate the unconscious mind. Those are the three things you want to do. And when you use the anchoring process we're going to go through in a moment, you will be doing all those three steps. And hence, you'll be creating a trigger and an unconscious anchor really quickly without really thinking about it, or without any problems that would normally arise around the edges of it. So we have to have a state. We need to create the right conditions, i.e. a hypnotic context, following the ABS formula. And finally, we need to create the association. In other words, we need to have a stimulus which gets associated to the response. So whenever you do the stimulus, they have the response. Those are the core elements that you'll need in order to be good at anchoring. Does all this make sense so far?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So, let's begin at the beginning. If we need something to anchor, in other words, we need to have a state, we need to be able to elicit states. In other words, states arrive in one of two ways. They arrive spontaneously. In other words, you respond to the context or situation you're in spontaneously, and you get a happy feeling, a confident feeling, a sad feeling, whatever. Now, spontaneously, that could be triggered by walking in, hearing an old song. By the way, that's an example of an anchor. It could be because you're in pleasant company. It could be all kinds of different things. The problem with spontaneous states is largely that you have no control over when they arise. And secondly, if they do arise, there is necessarily no hypnotic context, so that you may still not be able to anchor it as elegantly as other things. But spontaneous states can also be very powerful and therefore more useful things to anchor. So they have their upside and their downside. The second kind of states that, or the second method for states to arise, rather than being spontaneous, i.e. internally generated, is something you can elicit. In other words, you can go in and hunt for a certain state. You can go looking for it, and then you can activate it and build it up until it's something that's worth anchoring. Now, in that context, you should realize that human beings are basically state generators. We create states all the time. So that I would doubt that you spend any point, moment in time without a particular kind of state being active in your body. Now, some states you're so familiar with that they kind of fade into the background of your awareness and you don't even realize that you have them until they're no longer there. If you're a stressed person, then it isn't until the point that you start relaxing and you start feeling that slight sense of euphoria of that happening that you suddenly realize that you were stressed just a moment before. If you're more of a relaxed person, the reverse might be true. In other words, it might require a period of stress for you to realize that you normally used to be quite relaxed. The point is that we're always in a particular mind-body state, and whether we're aware of it or not. typically we tend to be more aware of it when it changes. And then, of course, if it's a more rare state, then we can really appreciate it more fully. So people are always in one state or another, and they're always cycling through states. Technically, a state only lasts between a few seconds and a minute or two, at which point the chemicals and the hormones that are being used in order to be able to create that experience have been used up, and unless they get replenished, you don't get to continue that state. So states are constantly being created, broken down, and recreated, and typically also being changed. So it's more like waves of an ocean than a solid mountain that is there and it's always been there and always will be there. It's something which is constant in the process of change. And this is very useful for us as hypnotists or as NLP practitioners, because it basically means if everything is constantly in change, then you can start nudging a particular wave in the direction that you want it to go in until that wave is in the location or the position or the shape that you want it to be in, and then you can anchor it. And once you've anchored it, then you can recreate the exact same wave in the exact same position and the exact same shape whenever you want to, just by firing off the anchor. Now, why are we focusing so much on states in terms of anchoring, given that conditioned responses were really all about anchoring in or conditioning in a response, in other words, a behavior to a stimulus? Any guesses why in NLP we tend to focus on the state rather than behavior?
Because the state drives the behavior?
Exactly right. States drive behavior. Go back to your universal molding process that we talked about in session one and is in your manual. Remember that once you have an internal representation, it affects the way that you feel, in other words, your state, and that affects the way you behave as well as your physiology. That chain actually goes in two directions. In other words, if you change the way that you behave, it will also change the way you feel, and that will ultimately change the way you think, so that you have a choice of intervention at any one of those levels. You get to choose to intervene at the level of thought, the internal representations, at the level of state, the level of feelings, or the level of behavior. If you're a more clinically or a psychiatrist of some sort, you may also consider chemical intervention as a valid one, and that has its place, but it's outside of the ambit of the scope of NLP. Let's put it this way. In NLP, you can use the way people think, the way people feel, and what states, as well as some behaviors, in order to affect every other part of the chain. And all the techniques that we are creating are going to be basically using one of those parts of that magic chain as the leverage point on which we focus. Anchoring focuses purely on states, purely and simply because it gives you a great leverage point in terms of people's thinking. In other words, when you do an anchor correctly and well, people will automatically reframe their thinking so that they'll think differently and they'll maintain that emotion. They'll also automatically change the way they behave. It's just part and parcel of a cycle. States are relatively easy to find, relatively easy to anchor, and relatively easy to fire off again. Hence, anchoring focuses on state as a general rule of thumb. Now, here's something that I really want to emphasize. Remember, the big problem with the traditional or classical stimulus response or conditioned response method is that it takes lots and lots of trials before you create a trigger, before you create a stimulus that actually will lead to a certain response reliably. The beauty of anchoring, of course, is that it can happen very, very quickly. And the difference is that we create a hypnotic context. Now, this is where NLP has created a very elegant set of tools, because the very process that you're going to use in order to elicit a state will actually create the hypnotic context you need in order to anchor it. Well, how do we mean this? Well, let's turn first of all to a couple of things. Number one, emotions are generated unconsciously. They are part and parcel of the unconscious mind. So if you have a strong unconscious response, in other words, when you have a strong emotional response, you already tend to have a strong hypnotic context. Why? Because when you feel something strongly, your logic no longer, your rational critical analysis no longer has the ability to influence those processes as fully anymore. Consider times when you are really sad or really upset. Now, people might have tried to cheer you up, but it didn't work. All the logic in the world just wasn't going to help. Why? Because you were in a state which was being driven unconsciously, and no amount of analysis could help you there and then. The same is true about positive emotions. Think about when you are in love. You know the old phrase that love blinds people? Well, guess what? It's true. When you have a strong emotional response, it tends to shut down some of the higher cortical activities, and you won't think in the same ways as you normally do. Hence, strong emotional responses have a lot of common ground with the hypnotic context. And as a rule of thumb, if you get a strong emotional response, you can ride that. It's a great big doorway into hypnosis, into trance. You can just ride that straight in and get the result you want. So, the very process that you're using to elicit a state can induce a hypnotic state. And at the same time, once you actually reach the state that you want, in other words, you activate a strong enough state which is worth anchoring, that in itself can be hypnotic also. So the very process sets you up to be able to do anchoring and do it very eloquently. Does that make sense?
Sure. So you don't need to do any sort of hypnotic process before then, particularly. That's all built in.
Exactly. You don't need to do it. You can do it. For example, when we get onto how do you elicit the state in a moment, you'll see that it's making use of a hypnotic process called revivification. So you can set the hypnotic context up beforehand, but you don't need to, because the very fact that you're going after a particular state in this particular way will create it. But, and here's the key thing, always remember ABS when you're doing your when you're hunting for states. You need to absorb their attention, you need to somehow bypass the critical factor, and by doing those two things, you open the doorway to stimulate the unconscious mind to be able to stimulate the state that you want and get it to come up spontaneously, or at least spontaneously when you call for it, right? Those are states that are true and pure. If you just say to someone, "Can you feel, go ahead and make yourself feel happy now," they'll go, "I don't know how to do that." I mean, how do you do that? How do you actually go about and do that? Most people don't know. But if they're in a hypnotic context and say, "Go ahead and make yourself feel happy," they'll just do it and they don't know how they're doing it. Why? Because their unconscious mind is doing it. So in order to get them to a position where you can say, for example, make them feel confident, you're always looking in the back of your mind at the ABS formula. Are you absorbing their attention by the questions and comments that you're making? Are you bypassing the critical factor? And remember, one great way to bypass the critical factor is through using your hypnotic language that we covered in session two. And other ways might be to distract their attention away from, the things that they are normally thinking about. And finally, are you stimulating them? And you do that basically by, making them think about certain contexts and scenarios. When those three things are present, they will end up having a strong emotional response, like confidence, like relaxation, like comfort, like inspiration, like excitement or enthusiasm, right? Once you have that, you now have the hypnotic context. So setting the anchor will be very, very straightforward because you've already set it up by the initial piece. Now, if you miss out on one of those things, for example, let's say you have someone who's very cynical, right? Cynical is another way of saying that they have an overactive critical factor. So that little part of their mind that analyzes stuff and rejects information, finds reasons for rejecting it, finds reasons for not liking it, finds reasons for why it's wrong. That's called a critical factor. And cynics tend to have that at a very highly developed sense of that, which can be useful at times, but can be absolutely soul-destroying at other times. So if you have someone who is being very cynical, who's being very critical or very analytical, who thinks too much, for example, these are all warning signs that you're going to have to do extra work during the B part of the process, the bypass the critical factor stage, in order to be able to create a pure state worth anchoring, and then being able to anchor it again. And this is again where a lot of NLP people fall foul, have a problem. They just think that they need to go to state and then just touch them on the shoulder, say, and it's done. And it's not done that way. It can be done that way, and if they're lucky, it will be done that way. And if they really, really believe it, it's more likely to happen that way, and I'll talk about that why in a moment. But it does not guarantee that it will happen that way. And if it doesn't happen that way, it doesn't tell them what else they should do in order to rectify the problem. But if you look at it from the point of view of ABS as a hypnotic process, then you know to look out for one of three things. Did you absorb their attention properly in some way? Did you bypass their critical factor, or are they still sitting there cynical as hell? Are you stimulating their unconscious mind properly? In other words, are you throwing in things that will stimulate the unconscious mind to have the experience that you're looking for? When you do all these three things, you'll get it. And if you're not getting it, then you can just do more of one of those parts of the process until you get the right combinations for the right individual. At which point, you're right back to where you need to be. You've got the hypnotic context, and then the anchoring part, the bit that amazes everyone, will be really straightforward and simple. There's an old saying in NLP that you do all your work before you actually do the work. So the bit that people actually see in NLP, that's the end part of the process. That's the bit that you do once you've already set everything else up, and once you've already got everything, all your ducks in a row ready to knock down, and then knocking them down will sound look really impressive, because most people miss the fact that you did all the work ahead of time. Does this begin to make sense to you guys now?
Yep.
Any questions so far?
Igor, how effective do you think anchoring is as a technique? Is it one of the most powerful techniques you've come across, or is it?
Well, I'd say in some respects, particularly talking about change work or influence, it's all anchoring. Now, there are many different ways to anchor. Sometimes you will anchor things by accident. Remember that just as the universal modeling process gives you a flow of ideas, for example, the internal representations change the way you feel, that changes the way you behave, and you can reverse the flow by changing the way you behave to change the way you feel, to change the way you think, and you can use the way you feel to change either of the others as well. It's like a three-point triangle. So the same is true of anchoring. Any technique or anything that you do will involve anchoring at some level, whether you're aware of it or not. And simultaneously, anchoring involves everything else you do as well. So for example, if you reframe something properly, the new reframe becomes the anchor, so that whenever they think of the situation with a new reframe, it anchors into them good feeling, so they start feeling good and seeing the whole thing in a different light. But you can also say that a good anchor is a reframe. So if you make someone feel good in a situation that they normally feel nervous in, suddenly they start thinking differently about it, start looking forward to it, and start behaving differently. So in a certain respect, you can say that these are all different ways of slicing up the same pie. If you imagine a mystical object out in space, and this mystical object is what allows people to change, to evolve, to be influenced. Now, we can't perceive that mystical object or ball, whatever it is, in a direct way. We have to like add a little bit of color into the solution to detect where it is. Now, one of those colored lenses might be anchoring. One of those colored lenses might be hypnosis. One of those colored lenses might be reframing. Another one might be some modalities. So in many respects, the complex or the sophisticated answer to your question is to say that all these different things are actually the same thing, but just different aspects of it, and you're just focusing on one face of it. Another way of saying it is to say that so that whenever you do something else, you'll be anchoring as well, and vice versa. But for the moment, just treat them as totally separate ideas inside your mind, just because it's easier to get the hang of. And once you get the hang of anchoring, you'll notice that when you do a submodality intervention, for example, you're actually anchoring by accident as well. And when you're giving a hypnotic suggestion, you're probably anchoring something in as well by accident. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
That was a very good question, by the way.